Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
We'll be speaking to Professor Bill Kohlbrenner, and we'll be talking about the New York Times. So there's a growing battle between Israel and sections of the international media. It has been suggested that Israel is going to be suing the New York Times. And the question is, to what end? We are just waiting for Professor Kohlbrenner to join us. And as soon as he does, we will have that conversation, because it really, really is, it is deeply, deeply problematic what people are able to, what people in the New York Times is able to write. And in a way, it is linked to the conversation that we had earlier, because the banning of pro-Israel voices or balanced voices that we heard about St. Mary's School from class a little bit earlier, talks to the same subject. Professor Bill Kohlbrenner, welcome and good morning. Hope you are well. Can you hear us? There we go. Are you with us?
I'm just having a little problem with the audio here, but I'm here.
Okay, we can hear you if that...
Perfect,
if,
good.
There
yeah,
we go.
I'm with you, good. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning. Okay, so it's such a complex subject, this one about the New York Times, Israel suing the New York Times, the New York Times themselves writing an absurd piece, which is meant to be an opinion piece, but it wasn't an opinion piece. You can't hide, I think, behind saying it's an opinion, but when you... you make these most appalling accusations. Just help me put this together in my mind. Why is this, and why has this particular column been so explosive?
You know, Howard, on the one hand, it's really, nothing is new under the sun here. Mm-hmm. This is a version of one of the oldest Jewish blood libels.
Yes.
That is that the Jews, baked Christian blood into matzot.
Yes.
How different is it to say that IDF soldiers, not only IDF soldiers, Howard, but the IDF canine unit was apparently deployed to rape Palestinian, trained and deployed to rape Palestinian women. You know, for people who live in this part of the world, it's very easy to imagine, this, whoever gave this witness testimony to the BBC reporter, going back to his friends and snickering and saying, what I just told that guy? And then Nicholas Kristof ends up publishing it in the New York Times. It's just the way things work here. People lie a lot. They're just waiting for cynical NGOs and naive people like Nicholas Kristof to go at it. And it really is a horrifying claim. And, the Guardian article about this is really about, not about how dare Bibi and the Israeli government, because as Israel is threatening to sue the New York Times. And it doesn't matter if they do or not. I mean, it was just a very good PR move. The Guardian article is all about how it's really not possible, when they should have been really focusing upon really the kinds of absurd claims that were made in the article. But Howard, we're used to all of this.
So a couple of things on this. If this article had been written 2.5 years ago, would it have been published? Number one. And number two, if not, what does that say about where we have gone and the road that we've traveled media-wise to get to this point?
Well, the New York City mayor, about whom we speak frequently, mm-hmm. Mamdani, he is being positioned right now as a kind of centrist Democrat. And I think that's a way of really it makes you laugh.
Yeah.
That's a way of really understanding where we're heading. It wouldn't have been published, nor would the article have been published about how Israel uses the Eurovision Song Contest as soft power. And of course, as you see, we came in second place. We'll never come in first place, because if we came in first place, it would have to be in Tel Aviv the following year.
Exactly.
And that's something the Europeans would never allow to happen. But that's another classic template of a libel against the Jews, the classic anti-Semitic stereotype that we control the world. And the fact that, as you said, they were both published, and then there's this kind of song and dance in the New York Times among the editorial committee that it really was justified, and you really can control opinion, blah, 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 blah. And I see on my Twitter feed and my Instagram feed, where I'm also talking about this, you know, people are just saying, you know, why don't you accept the fact that you're guilty? And I'm reading right now, I'm holding up for Howard, Merchant of Venice. And what's crazy about this play, Howard, is that the Jew makes a deal. Antonio Bassanio, the non-Jew, defaults on it. So they tell the Jew, you have to be merciful. When he refuses to give up his legitimate claim, they take all of his money and they forcefully convert him. And we all go along with it. And the reason we all go along with it, and Shakespeare knows this, is because we always assume the Jew is guilty. That's why Christoph just plugs into those outlets that are just always available. You know, we've lived this personally, Howard. We thought, you know, anti-Semitism was a thing of the past, but we didn't even think about it. We were part of a new reality, the second half of the 20th century. I think we're about the same age. You and I really rode the wave of privilege and thank God, and success. But that's really changed now. And we understand now that anti-Semitism is not something, it just went into remission. You know, as Rabbi Sachs does, it's a virus. It went into remission, and now it's coming out full force. And it's like an undeniable fact of Western culture.
I was talking to a friend the other day, and we were saying that when, as a kid, we heard this, and I was telling listeners about this as well, the blood libels, the matzah, and the blood. As a kid, you think, how do they actually believe that? And then you kind of think, well, maybe it was Eastern Europe, and maybe it was, you know, the people weren't educated then. They were ignorant, I don't know, Cossacks, whatever they were. And then now we listen to the story, this absurd notion of Israel training their dogs to rape Palestinian prisoners. I mean, just saying it is beyond. And there are people that believe it. And the New York Times publishes it. How did we...
Howard, you know, we have won a lot of Nobel Prizes. We're kind of good at stuff.
It's true.
That's the thing about the Jews, that we've been outsiders for so long. So when we come into a new culture and you know, I think we could really talk in America about the Jewish half century, the second half of the 20th century. We made America, the civil rights movement, but most of all, I think really standardized testing, where we said, you know, we are going to find a way for our merit to shine, and other minorities have followed through with that. But, you know, English literary studies in the university was created by Jews. We came out of the Holocaust, out of Auschwitz, out of the ovens. And then we decided to become experts in the religion of the people who had been persecuting us for two millennia. It's crazy. But that's the thing about us, that we are very capable people. So that's part of it also, you know, and just think about the stuff that the bombs that went off in people's pockets. I know you got in trouble for that. The phone explosions.
Yes, it wasn't the first time.
So we do have a kind of competence which strengthens the anti-Semitic tropes.
I don't want to. I think what we do very often is we turn inward and we say, well, maybe this is our fault, therefore I'm hesitant to even raise this. But I do think it's a valid discussion. How much of this is our fault in that Israel has, I think, been quite appalling in a lot of its media handling of this war? It's always been poor at PR. I don't think it's really understood communication properly. And maybe it doesn't care, or it hasn't cared until now, but it very clearly should care, because it makes a difference. How much of could we have done, or could Israel have done, to not allow the situation to get to this point?
Well, Howard, first of all, I'd say, you know, Shavuot is coming up, and the third tablet that we receive is guilt. So we always feel guilty.
Right, exactly.
But how would, in your view, would Israel PR or Hasbara, how would it be better?
I'll tell you how it could be better. And I don't think it could be better. You can't look at this particular case and say, well, how should it have dealt with it differently? Because I believe that this article is a culmination of events that led to it. So let's put that aside. Mm. How could Israel have done better? I think that towards the beginning of October 7th, the October 7th war, there was a very clear communication to people outside of Israel, to people like myself who are fighting a battle in the diaspora, and we are on the front lines. And I think communication information was good. Okay, that then we saw internal politics. We saw Elon Levy being fired because Sarah didn't like him, etc. Off he goes, and then they struggle with all sorts of things. We've got Ben Gvir saying stupid things. We don't have a particular strategy, I think, that has worked. Number two is, and I always use this example, and my listeners are going to get very, very bored of it, but I think it's valid, is that when you market something, you don't always sell facts. And I'm going to use the same example I always use. People buy iPhone because it sells status, not because iPhone is better than another phone. And you can tell an iPhone user 1,000 times why Samsung is better. You're not going to convince them because they bought status, not the actual quality of the phone. What that's doing is it's selling something that isn't fact. It's selling a feeling, it's selling an emotion, right? When Israel is accused of raping Palestinians, the first thing we do is defend the facts, which we have to do. I get it. But in fact, they're not selling facts. Deep down, they know that this is a lie. They know it's rubbish. But the reason that it gets repeated is not because it's so convincing. It's because they've bought into an emotion. So for me, it's actually very simple, is that the whole strategy around communication and Israel has been a failure. Half of these people marching have no idea what the facts are. And we're always fighting to say, Ken, we need to get in front of you. We need to have a voice. We need to tell you the facts. But they don't care, because those facts, even if I tell you the facts, even if I tell them the fact, it's not going to make a difference. So what I'm saying to you is the media landscape and the public sentiment landscape is vital. It leads to governments making poor decisions. It leads to all sorts of things. And I'm not convinced that Israel has created that environment. I'm interviewing you, but I've just given you a whole spiel. Response.
I'll put it on my resume. Then the question, I guess, is what? How would we brand Howard? How would you?
No. First, respond to the concept.
I'm asking myself a rhetorical question here.
Okay.
And I think part of what we would insist upon is the kind of complexity and layered versions of who we are. That is, it's so easy to put us in a kind of allegorical narrative. I always say this about my academic colleagues who are suspicious of allegory. Allegory is like, you know, cowboys and Indians, good guys and bad guys. Mm. And we're very suspicious of that kind of genre because we know the world is not like that. Oh, except when it comes to Israel-Palestine, then it's like that.
Very binary.
And what Israel has, but Israel has bara, and this is their problem, is they are part of that binary, is they become cheerleaders. And we can't just be cheerleaders for the state of Israel and think that people are going to connect to our good feeling. You know, I'm sitting in a cafe right now, Howard. I'm looking at three Arabs at the counter, an Ethiopian couple, an elderly, obviously Ashkenazi European man in a wheelchair. This is such a diverse country. And what we have to really do is show our diversity. This is what I do with in my side job with writing on the wall. that we decided we wanted to create a version, a brand for Israel, not a brand, but I think you're right in using that term, in which we're not insisting on one perspective. We all, everybody who we publish in our magazine, Balagan, or on our website, Writing on the Wall, everybody believes in two things. One is the future of a democratic and Jewish Israel. Those are the guardrails. If you're out of those guardrails, we don't care. You want to emphasize Jewish, I emphasize Jewish, Ronit emphasizes Israeli. Let's show the diversity of who we are and not just cheerlead, because that fits into the binary and that's easy to respond to. It's just this black or white thing that just keeps on going back and forth.
I guess another aspect is, and Alex says, the core issue here is I still think we are trying too hard to fit in. We just have to be Jews, live our life the way the Torah demands it, and we'll actually be okay.
Don't worry, be happy. You know, Alex, I agree with you, and I would just go a little further and just say that what we have to do, Howard, I think our listeners, we've said this before, it's not a matter so much of, as you just said, checking the facts. We have to do that. But we have to build this community, as Alex says, whether it's through Torah, mitzvot, or the oral law as very, very, very broadly defined, meaning all of Jewish culture, all of Jewish music from for 2,000 years, then I think that's what we have to do. Create strength for ourselves internally. Because as you said, it's like the receptors are always out there for anti-Semitism. They're just waiting for the hate. And then it just activates them. So, Alex, 100% right.
So let's go back. I've got to use a horrible term. Let's circle back to the New York Times. What do you think is happening within those walls at the moment? Do you think that at 5 a.m. in their loneliest moments, they recognize that, this was a bit silly, or are they so steadfast on their with their conviction?
I think they have an explicit editorial strategy, and I think they pursue it at any cost that they want. I know authors like Matti Friedman and others have talked about when they wanted to place pro-Israel or not anti-Israel pieces in the Times, there were delays, all sorts of kind of technical things that stopped things from happening. I think they have a very explicit policy and they're pursuing it. Just like Mamdani in New York City yesterday, said today is the Nakba day on which 700,000 Palestinians were displaced. I mean, first of all, why is the New York mayor, why does he have a foreign policy? Why is he broadcasting? And then second of all, as we know, what was actually left out about the Nakba? 700,000, I'm sure that's not even true, were displaced. What just happened? I mean, no mention that, Israel declared war. There was a partition plan. The Palestinians, as they habitually do, said no. And the seven nations went to war against it. Oh, that's the Nakba. But again, I think, Howard, it's more alarming. I think people are coming out and saying we have an explicit, we're demonizing Israel, and we see how it's happening in American Congress. The Democratic Party will be lost to the Jewish people. We should be our strongest defenders, not for the future.
Do you think this is the hill that the New York Times is going to die on?
Howard, I remember buying the New York Times Sunday paper and taking out the arts and leisure section first and the sports pages after. I mean, it's such a part of my life, or was. I don't see the New York Times dying on any hill. Are we going to make are Jews going to make this happen? I don't know. Maybe I'm naive, but I think the powers of anti-Semitism are much, much stronger than the powers of people who want to defend it. I saw Deborah Lipstadt. She commented, it was quoted in a Guardian article, and she says about Christoph, have you no decencies? Do you remember where that comes from? It's from the McCarthy trials. Brilliant of Deborah to say that. So she's essentially saying, and this was directed by a lawyer against McCarthy, have you no decency? And that's what Deborah says to Christoph. Have you no decency, really? And I think the answer is no.
I think a resounding no. That is where we leave it. Professor Bill Kolbrenner, thank you. As always, give me your thoughts on 061. It's a complex issue, but I would love to hear from you. Rene says, morning, Howard. The way Israel can fight the media war is by not defending who we are, but naming and shaming who they are. in my humble opinion. Garth said, I think South Africa has benefited greatly from a Jewish presence. Thank you for sending that, Garth.